Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Welcome to the third episode of the 8th of September 2018 New Scientist podcast. Now, this podcast has been modified or evolved into a quiz format in which I'll ask a quiz question at the start, read the article, and then give the answer. The theory behind it is an education theory of scan, question, read, review, and recall when you're studying a text. It's probably a good thing to do. So we're going to have our quiz question here. Again, the title is EU Flights. Now, the EU aviation emits 150 megatons of CO2 each year. Being in the EU, they set carbon emission targets. What is the carbon emission target for EU aviation by 2030? Is it 90 megatons? 110 megatons? 120 megatons, 130 megatons. That's the question. Now we'll read the article. So it's a short article, a longer article, so I'm going to have to try to remember more things, so I've got to actually remember what the answer was. The aviation industry is trying to stop countries doing more to limit greenhouse gas emissions from flying. Okay, so the industry's the bad people. But the European Union has formally objected to the industry scheme, leaving it free to impose stricter plans. I think it's always free. Flying generates more than 2% of the carbon dioxide globally, and the emissions are expected to double before 2050. Most countries are doing nothing about it, as aviation emissions are excluded from the UN climate agreements. EU nations are an exception, as aviation fuel sold within the bloc is subject to a form of carbon pricing. In 2016, the International Civil Aviation Authority came up with its own plan. But rather than limit future emissions, the proposed carbon offsetting and reduction scheme for international aviation, Corsica, involves offsetting them, and that is paying for other schemes that reduce carbon emissions. However, offsetting is ineffective. A 2017 EU report concluded that 85% of UN schemes had failed to deliver the promised reductions. Corsica would still be better than nothing if it were the first step towards further action. Sir Andrew Murphy of the Transport Environment in Brussels, which campaigns to make transport greener and healthier. Instead, the aviation industry wants to make it the only action permitted. Any additional measures, such as carbon taxes on jet fuel, would be forbidden. These proposals would allow the air industry to claim it was taking action on climate, yet it places no limit on future growth. EU aviation emissions are projected to rise to 150 megatons of CO2 a year today, to 210 megatons by 2030. The EU's target is to cut this to 110 megatons by 2030. If it were bound by Corsica alone, it would have no way to achieve it, as offsets aren't recognised under EU law. Okay, so they can't achieve it, not because they're physically offsetting, and there's not net amount, it's just that it's not recognised under the law. So the answer is... by 2030, they want to go from 150 to 110 megatons. Okay, we're on to our next article. And this article is called Cape Art May Show Finger Sacrifice. And they've got pictures of hands, the entire hand splattering. but various fingers aren't look to be amputated. Okay, so for one quiz question here, I might have to stop. I'm just reading. I'll avoid a number one for you. Okay. The authors suggest that women removed and ate one of their fingers, this is a prehistoric woman, in order to avoid pregnancy. True or false? I think I'll leave it at that true or false, because this article has, just reading through it, has a nice sort of common sense thing to it. Okay, so it's cave art may show finger sacrifice. So this is what I call page filler stuff. You know, they've got some scientific magazine, they want a bit of science, a bit of a picture, it's got enough to go through. And it's by Michael Marshall. Stone Age Europeans may have deliberately amputated their fingers during religious ceremonies. The idea could explain why so many prehistoric images of hands on cave walls are missing fingers, but not everyone agrees. Okay, I have not seen this before. This is the first cave art I've ever seen with a missing finger, but it's so many that would need to be established. Images of hands, whether handprints or stencils, are some of the most common forms of cave art. Two French caves called Gragas and Cosca are known for their unusual hand images. Well, good God, so it's not so many, it's just these, and they're unusual. Let's see what they said. Explain why so many. It's unusual, so it's not so many. It's a contradiction. Of the 231 hand images in Gargas, 114 have at least one finger segment missing, while Cosca hands has 49 hand images and 28 which are missing finger segments. So, what are we looking at? something over 50% for each. Nobody knows why. One suggestion is that the people's hands were intact and they folded fingers when making the pictures, perhaps as a simple counting system. Or maybe people lost the fingers to frostbite. So we have to, this has to be in France. Losing one finger, oh dear. Mark Curlin and Simon Fraser at the University of Columbia, Canada, and his colleagues wondered if instead the people had removed their fingers on purpose. Unless your wondering gets you in there. To find out if this is plausible, they examined ethnographic studies conducted since the 17th century to see how many human societies practiced fingers amputation. They found 121 societies that did it. I was pretty shocked, says Collard. It seems like such a debilitating practice that I couldn't imagine signing up to do it myself. The team found 10 reasons people amputated their fingers, including as a marker of group identity, as a punishment. In some society, voluntary finger removal represented a religious sacrifice done to appeal a supernatural being. Oh, gee. It's a religious thing, not super. It has to be supernatural. For instance, some women removed and ate fingers to encourage pregnancy. Collard suspects Stone Age humans also removed their fingers as a sacrifice. Such unpleasant experiences can enhance cooperation within a group and encourage distrust of outsiders. Mm-hmm. Here's a salesman. Oh, I've lost my finger. Collard emphasizes that this is a hypothesis. It is one than that other archaeologists reject. Ian Guion, the University of Sydney, thinks frostbite is more likely. None of the ethnographic cases they cite match the distinctive patterns seen in the Ice Age hand stencils, namely a sequential shortening of the fifth and fourth third finger with the thumb spared, he says. But the pattern corresponds to frostbite damage, he adds. There is no reason to think people's fingers were removed at all, says Peter Dunn of Durham University, because they could simply fold their fingers. The most ethnographic examples involve the removal of the little finger, he says. The hand stencils at carcass caves have up to four fingers missing. Nobody would be idiotic enough to remove every finger bar the thumb. That simply makes no sense, says Peter. Okay, well, the answer here is it is in false. They didn't remove, ethnographically, women didn't remove and eat their fingers to avoid pregnancy, but to encourage pregnancy. Now, this raises a whole lot of issues, but this person is saying, well, they're just saying it's a hypothesis, and they're just trying to flesh out the likelihood of their hypothesis there, and I suppose that's an important thing to go. It is amazing the number of students. If you have a class and you ask a multiple choice question like this, there is actually a number of students who, you know, out of 30, you'll probably get two who would say to avoid pregnancy, even reading it. It's just the way, it's just random noise going across here. This article is so, I suppose, titillating that I won't have a quiz question in front of it. The article is by Chelsea White, "Does Sex with a Robot Count as Cheating?" Okay. A study exploring the morals of sex robots has found that people tend to be okay with the idea of a single person paying to use a sex robot, but less if someone is in a relationship. That is according to Mika Kolva, the University of Helsinki, Finland, who asked more than 300 people to judge the moral character and actions of people in a futuristic scenario. The story was set in the year 2035, in which a person, either male or female, single or married, decided to visit a brothel. Depending on the scenario, a sign read either, "You cannot tell our robots from real humans," or "All our workers are real humans." Participants were asked to judge the actions of the characters on a scale of 1 to 7. Obviously, you need a 1 to scale 7, you don't do 1 to 10 or 1 to 8. At 7 is interesting because it means that they're not going to get a 3.5, although I would do. They were simply more likely to condemn a married person than a single one who visited the brothel. This is sex. Okay. The researcher also asked study participants about their personal sexual history and found those who self-reported having more sexual partners were more permissive towards the idea of visiting a brothel, regardless of the nature of the sex worker. Women more harshly condemned characters than men. Relationships seem to drive how people morally judge the use of sex robots, says Thomas Arnold of Tufts University at Milford, Massachusetts. The more you start thinking about it as something that could compete against and interfere with your relationship, that seems to be what people morally object to. Sex robots aren't likely to look or act like humans anytime soon, but plans for robot brothels are already in the works. In Texas, a proposed robot brothel was blocked from opening by a local council. Sorry, a similar facility is planned in California. Attitudes towards sex robots may vary between cultures, and the team plans to look at those differences, says Colavera. Okay, well, I must admit, what is the exact scientific value of that particular article? Again, so for this article, which is called "Ancient Whales Hunted and Sucked Up Large Prey," for this quiz question is, how does the modern salmon eat? Does it lick, suck, bite, or filter its food? So it's lick, suck, bite, or filter its food. Now let's read the article, and it's no author here. Toothless prehistoric whales might have sucked their prey out of the ocean over 10 million years before becoming filter feeders. Okay, so let's start talking about the different things. So filter feeders is they take in the water, and then it's obviously no use having the filter and you suck in the water and filter out the food. You know, what you want to do is suck in the food and then push the water out. So filtering must come afterwards. And so baleens have this huge amount of, they don't have teeth, they've got all this fur. You know, this, all these long hairs coming down, baleens they're called. Whales were once toothed predators. Around 36 million years ago, some evolved to be toothless. This is interesting. So whales, the closest whale, I think it's a cow or a dog, they've gone back, become aquatic. We don't know what drove that, but ultimately it gave rise to today's filter-feeding whales. These animals, including blue whales, humpback whales, pictured, use baleen bristles in their mouth to catch prey like plankton. So they take in the water and then they pump the water out through their baleens. Scientists had assumed that filter feeding system emerged before whales lost their teeth. And now, Carlos Perez at George Mason University in Virginia and his colleagues have found a 33-million-old skull fossil of an extinct whale has neither teeth nor baleen. So what are they doing? Using CT scans, so computerized tomography, so they put it in a place and swing the X-ray machine on a ball bearing, sorry, on a roller bearing. The team found the Malabali nanibitae had no teeth sockets. It also had a different mouth structure to a baleen whale, so it couldn't filter feed either. So the baleens have to open their mouth wide enough, get the water in, and then sort of like filter feeding soup through holes in your teeth. How did they catch a prey? Plato says this whale was probably a suction feeder like modern salmon or trout. The whale had enlarged bones at the back of its mouth, like those observed in suction feeding fish. Such bones help the mouth's muscle regulate a strong sucking force. Plato thinks fetal feeding, which targets many small creatures, may have ultimately evolved because this was more efficient than hunting than a few large predators suck up. So that's pretty amazing. So the trout feeds by actually going up and actually sucking the water into it. So it doesn't bite the fish. It just, the trout goes in front of the little fish and sucks in like a pool pump, sucks it in. So that's a pretty amazing piece of thing. This great cosmic light display is all gone. So for this question, you're going to be told that after the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, 13.8 billion years ago, matter collapsed, and when it collapsed into stars, the stars began undergoing nuclear fusion and generating heat. So this process didn't start immediately, but it took off eventually. And a process proceeded generating stars. And the question is, how many years after the Big Bang did this process reach full peak brightness? Was it, given that we're 13.8 billion years, was it 2 billion years ago? Sorry, 2 billion years after the Big Bang? 4 billion years after the Big Bang? 8 billion years after the Big Bang? 16 billion years after the Big Bang? So it's only billion years. That's 16,000 million years. Okay, let's listen to the story. It seems we missed the show. Star formation at the universe peaked 10 billion years ago. The light of all the stars in the galaxy is called the extragalactic background light. This is built over the history of the universe. To find out more extra. To find out more about this light and how it changed, an international team used the Fermi Gamma-ray telescope to look at over 740 cosmic objects that emitted light, emitted high-energy gamma rays. The extragalactic background light can block some photons from the gamma rays, so they don't make it to the telescope. By comparing the properties of the gamma ray sources with the numbers of gamma rays the telescope detected, the team could measure how dense the background light is, and thus the rate of formation of the stars that created it. Light from very distant sources takes billions of years to reach us. The range of distances of the objects of studies means the team could reconstruct the history of star formation for over 90% of the cosmic time. It found that star formation peaked less than 4 billion years after the Big Bang. Oh, God. Quote, "We can't have missed the party, and it's been a declining ever since," says team Carla Hagelson, the University of Ireland. So if I can unpick this, it's saying that obviously gamma rays are short from, you know, things for the nucleus of stars. Now, if I read this correctly, this article correctly, and I fully don't understand it, it says that the gamma rays coming to us collide with a photon of light. I just can't quite understand it. Let me read that one again. Extragalactic background light can block some photons from the gamma rays so they don't make it to the telescope. Well, that's the key thing. They're saying that they can have a light-light collision. That does not make physics sense to me, because they're both bosons, and so both, you know, you can't have light colliding each other. But according to this article, it can. So I'll just leave that with you. It doesn't actually make scientific sense. But they're saying that the X-ray light can actually measure the amount of light that's around the place. So if there's a lot of light here, X-rays don't get through. Gamma rays don't get through. It almost hurts me to think about this. There's another article here, which I just have to read with you. It's sort of just scientifically hurts me to read it. And I'll just read it to you. I won't ask a question. Question 4. Eco tires recharges your car's batteries. A new type of tire can trap the static electricity that builds up between it and the road to help recharge the vehicle's batteries. Okay, firstly, how you get a rotating source, and generally the way that you trap electricity with rubber is being done with the Van de Graaff generator. But let's read it. Previous research has shown that friction between the car tire and the road counts between 5 to 30% of the vehicle's fuel use. There's two different things. Oh, we're going to have to talk about it. Okay, one of the myths is that a car, the one stationary point on a car is always the car tire surface. So what's happening is that your car, the centre of the wheel is going at the average velocity, the top of the wheel is travelling forward at twice the velocity of the car, and the base of the wheel in contact with the road is going at, was always stationary. This is the genius of the wheel. So if you just try to put that to you, that a wheel, there's always one stationary part of the wheel, and that's the part in contact with the road. If it's so it wants high friction, and so what I think they're talking about is rolling friction here. So the friction is actually not between, it's between the car tire and the road. It counts from, that would be skidding. So if you have friction that does work on the road, that is a force over a distance, that would be skidding. So I don't quite understand it. Now Wing Yang of the University of Science and Technology Beijing and his colleagues have designed a tire that can recycle some of the wasted energy, the part that ends up as static electricity. Like what fraction? Normal tires made of rubber and carbon black. Ah, that's why they look so black. Wang's version swaps the latter for silica. It generates more static electricity by including nanogenerators made of rubber and copper in the tyre. The electrons that cause the static charge can be captured and funneled to the car battery. They can, okay? A tyre like this could save 800 kilojoules of energy per year. I don't know, there's a small cup of petrol. There's a huge, there's megajoules of 800 kilojoules. It's really... like, say, my mind is blown away by this. So there's the piezoelectric effect, which is where a crystal deforms and produces a voltage. There's a whole heap of this thermoelectric effects. I'll have to go through. Revise my knowledge. There's ferro effects and stuff like that. I just think this is just the most unlikely set of things going ahead. The history of humans gets another twist. I'll just read this one through. It finishes on this page. A collection of stone tools in Algeria is challenging ideas about human evolution. Or surely the analysis of the collection, not the actual tools, you know, going up, oh, we'll challenge it. It wasn't until the last 3 million years that true humans in a Homo sapiens genus evolved. Evidence suggests that they did so in East Africa, but Muhammad's and, where is it, Algeria's West Africa. But Mohamed Sanouni of the National Research Center of Evolution, Human Evolution in Spain, and his colleagues have found primitive tools at Aln Bolcheti in Algeria. Okay, so the tools are simple things. There's this big transition only around, I don't know, not long ago, in terms of 3 million years ago, 500,000 years ago, where humans began to make more than one set of tools out of a rock. Normally they would see a rock and make it into a tool and throw the waste away. These plus other signs suggest hominids were there 2.4 million years ago. The simplest explanation still with the team is that humans evolved in East Africa and spread rapidly to reach North Africa. But it is possible early hominids had spread across Africa in all and all gradually evolved into humans. Okay, so, I don't know how that's necessarily challenging it. So, the assumption is that the hominids from 3 million years ago began using tools, and we've only evolved as a separate organism. Sorry, as a separate subspecies, breed. We're more like a breed of humans. So the fire tools, all various characteristics of humans began going in Homo erectus and various other aspects. Interesting thing is that the Neanderthal brain is larger than our brain cavity. So what's going on there? So it's just not brain, it's brain, society, culture. Goes together to make up humans. Okay, just quickly scan reading this article. I'm not going to ask a question about it's. Some bees can have 4 parents. Okay, I just have some overall questions about this one. We know some honeybees are born partly male and partly female. Now a closer look can reveal. They can have up to 4 parents, and some of them have no mother at all. I think bees, depending on how you actually you've got the female workers, and then you've got the male drones, but I think it concerns male or female on environment, not on fertilisation. In bees, unfertilised eggs are developed into males or drones who seek out queens to mate with. Yeah, that's right. So if the queen is running out of fertilisation and she produces the next eggs, that eggs is a male egg. So say you are a queen and you had a fair amount of sperm given to you, you produce the eggs, and then eventually when you run out, you start producing more males. That's the way it works. Fertilized eggs usually become female workers. However, queens mate with at least 10 males to produce new colony members. The more than one sperm enters each egg. Okay. In a few rare instances, bee can end up with some tissue derived from fertilized eggs, which is female, some from the next sperm, which is male. But it's overall a female. The resulting animals are known as gynadomorphs. They have both female and female tissue throughout their body. Okay, so it's something like the double X for humans. What is it called? Oh, I've really forgotten what that term is. It's for a C something or other. Sarah Amor and colleagues at the University of Sydney, Australia, studied 11 Gynadomorphs honeybees from a single colony to learn more about how these individuals develop. So you can imagine them being a fairly useless female if they've got some male parts going on. Five had normal worker ovaries, three had queen-like ovaries. So queen-like ovaries are pretty big egg-producing ovaries. One had normal male reproductive organs, and two partial male organs. Genetic tests revealed the unusual family history of 10 of these bees. So 10 rather than 11. Nine had two or three fathers and one mother. One had no mother and two fathers, resulting from the fusion of two sperm. Now that is really rather hard to believe, that last one. That's complicated. I have an egg, and the egg's got really nothing in it. I suppose it would have... that's complicated to believe. So really the production of an insect, as far as a bee is concerned, is just really... whatever. Yeah, if you produce an egg, it will develop whatever. So if it's unfertilized, it'll turn into a male, which starts spreading it. You know, it's almost to say, I don't have enough sperm to spread. It sounds really interesting. Spider mum gives young milk from her abdomen. I'm sure that's why they said that. Spider man. Okay, I'm sure that's supposed to be read like that. Baby spiders may be more like our young than we thought. There definitely is in terms of the central nervous system. Their mothers can produce nutritious milk-like fluid to feed offsprings. That's strange. If it's a fluid produced by a mother, don't we define it as milk? I don't understand. Juvenile spiders eat various kinds of food, insects in some species, pollens in others. Early research also found that some spiders simply don't eat until large enough to hunt. But the Toxus magnus, a type of jumping spider native to Southeast Asia, jumping spiders are so cute. They've got this big set of eyes, you know, to look at you, and they jump, little things. Okay, its young grow shockingly fast. They reach almost half adult size in the first 20 days of life. But neither the youngster nor the mother leave the nest to gather food. Now it is quite interesting to see some of these spiders go around the place and their back is seething with baby spiders. It's pretty amazing. After Zhang Qichen of the Chinese Academy of Science spotted the young of the species clinging to the mother's abdomen, he investigated further. Cheng and his colleague put the mother spiders under the microscope and gently squeezed the abdomen. A little creamy white fluid came out, which looked similar to mammalian milk. Analysts found that liquids contain fat and four times as much protein as cow milk. Well, surely that's, the spiders are hydraulic, so they've got lots of fluid in them for all things like that. I think this is... The team prevented the mother's spiders from excreting milk. Baby spiders died within 10 days. Okay, it's not scientific as far as I'm concerned. It means the milk, quote-unquote, is indispensable for survival of newborn spiders. But it's not that the spiders are eating it. The milk may have some sort of complicated function. And while the young magnets start hunting for food 20 days after hatching, they don't wean until they're 40 days old. Well, that is interesting. It's also interesting that spiders don't have mouths. They only have openings and can only suck in the food. Milk secretion is exclusive to mammals. Even so, the team have named the new liquid spider milk. As they say, it seems to serve the same purpose. Okay, continue to read here. A gene therapy for treatment rewires faulty brain circuits. A gene therapy for Parkinson's disease. Bye bye, darling. You have a lovely time.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.